Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the greatest monuments and spectacular structures such as the Great Pyramid of Giza or the tremendous Lighthouse of Alexandria were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. Other Magnificent Sevens recognized the Great Wall of China, the Taj Mahal, and so on. Or awesome wonders of the natural world, such as the Grand Canyon, the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is the comedian and actor Hugh Dennis. In an extensive TV career for more than 15 years, Hugh has been a fixture on the panel show Mock the Week. He was also the hapless husband and father in the domestic comedy series Outnumbered, and has had significant roles in the groundbreaking Fleabag, as well as more traditional sitcoms My Hero and Not Going Out. Since his days as a student, he's been in a comedy partnership with Steve Punt. Together, they've been presenting The Now Show on Radio 4 for what must be several decades now. So, Hugh, I'm making that distinction between being a comedian who can come out with quips on a panel show or stand-up comedy and an actor who can act. So you've got both of those. Did you, which came first, and did you always want to be a performer?
No, I didn't want to do any of it, frankly. It was a very sort of happy accident. So when I left university, I went into marketing until I was about, how old was I when I left? I suppose I was sort of 27 or 28, I suppose.
So you had a proper job selling, what, it was Unilever you worked for,
yeah,
wasn't it?
So
domestic products?
Yeah, it was all personal products. So I worked on toothpaste. I launched actually one of the shortest lived toothpastes in British history, a thing called Mentadent Gel, which was for children. Lasted, I think, about 3 months before it was pulled off the shelves. But I ended up
I've never heard of it, so no? The marketing wasn't brilliant.
No, it really wasn't. It had the strap line. This may be the reason. It went, Mentadent Gel, be chums with your gums. That was the line. You can understand its lack of success.
That was your first bit of writing ever.
Brilliant. But then I ended up as the brand manager of Lynx. But I was doing comedy at the same time. I had a rather odd introduction to it all, really. So I started in Footlights in Cambridge. And then at the end of that, I had no idea you could do it as a career, really. I was sort of tremendously naive in that respect. So I got a proper job, but carried on working with Steve throughout that period.
Yeah. But the point I was trying to just address early on is that, you know, being an actor in a sitcom or a play or even playing a part in an advert even, there's a slightly different skill to that than just being, you know, a bit droll about the week's news or a joke and a bit of banter. So that acting skill, you didn't go to drama school or anything like that to get that perfected.
No, I didn't do any of that, actually. And that's, you know, I suppose I started as a sketch actor rather than a stand-up. And I don't think I've ever been a stand-up, really. And I don't think I've ever really quite known what it is that I do, which I think is probably true of lots of people. But no, but it's great. I mean, it's brilliant to be able to do both in a, you know, fairly modest sort of way.
Well, I don't know. I dare say you are modest, but your achievements aren't modest. But let's get on with the wonders of the world, because that's the point of this podcast. What's your first wonder?
Well, I have I've developed a list of seven wonders. I'm not quite sure which order to put them in.
All right. Well, I'll help you the order, because I was working on the list that you sent in, and your first one was the ball.
Well, the ball, I think, is a proper. And incidentally, in all the wonders of the ancient world that you talked about, I find many of them very disappointing. Have you visited many of the wonders of the world, the original ones? I mean, clearly not the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Were they one?
There aren't. Other than the Great Pyramid, they've all gone. So you can't visit them anymore.
But do you not think that the Great Pyramid itself is rather, it's sort of disappointing, isn't it? I mean, in the sense that it's in a suburb of Cairo where it looks in exactly the spot where you would now put a Pets at Home. If that was in England, it's in exactly that area. Sort of suburban Cairo. It doesn't detract at all from the building of the pyramids, but, you know, you don't go there and think, wow, this is absolutely amazing.
This is an unusual start for you, Hugh, I think, because we're supposed to be doing your wonders and you're attacking other people's wonders.
Well,
Hugh, I want to get on to your wonders, and so I'm going to apply some rigor to your wonders.
Okay, they are nothing like. They are nothing like the pyramids. So the first one is indeed the ball. Now, the reason I've included the ball is because I think, you know, in all the histories of the world, etc., they go, you know, one of the great advances was the invention of the wheel, which enabled travel and transport and enabled the Industrial Revolution through cogs and all the rest of it. And I have always thought, I don't think that is as big a breakthrough as the ball. Because the wheel is essentially just a kind of a two-dimensional version of a ball with far fewer uses, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, You can roll the ball, you could attach it to a cart if you felt like it. You'd still be able to do all the same things like we did with the rollerball wheelbarrow, very unsuccessful invention of the 1970s.
Well, that was James Dyson, wasn't it? That was his big breakthrough, but it doesn't seem to... And I think he lost control of it. I mean, not the wheelbarrow,
not
but the actual invention. But I was looking around the other day, and you don't see them on sale. So a ball doesn't turn out to be a vital thing for a wheelbarrow.
But essentially, the difference between the ball and the wheel is that the ball also enables you to play, doesn't it? I mean, I think that's the key thing about the ball. When I, you know, think of the amount of time in my life that I have spent either chasing a ball or hitting a ball or throwing a ball or watching people do exactly the same things. I've actually no idea what I would have done with the time had the ball not been invented.
Well, I sometimes speculate that I might achieve much more in life if the ball hadn't been invented, because I have a few friends, not many, but a few friends who take no interest in football, for example. And I think, well, what a huge amount of spare time they've got. They're not rushing to home to watch a game or to read a report of why Arsenal threw it away in the last 5 minutes or something. All that effort is out of their life. They must be able to write novels and to create buildings, do all sorts of things. So, but you and I are perhaps in the same category. We do waste or spend a lot of time in ball watching.
I think it's spend, actually. And it's even, you know, from early childhood. You know, if a ball wasn't available, you'd find something that was roughly the shape of a ball. I mean, how much football have you played with an apple, for example, or an orange? You don't think of them intrinsically as pieces of fruit. You think of them as balls, which can be thrown and trapped and volleyed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. It's just an amazing thing, the ball.
Have I remembered this right? Were you sort of captain of sports at your school? Were you a big, you know, the person that people turn to for ball games and other sports?
I played a lot of sports. So I was at a school which wasn't terribly good at sport. We should put that, we should say that straight off. I was the captain.
You were the fantastically named school, the University College School. I mean, how much more stress on academia could they put? They could call it an academy, I suppose. University College School Academy.
Yeah. But it does carry with it a problem in the name, which is that on all forms, when you're filling in, you know, application forms for university or jobs or whatever, there's always a box that goes university stroke college stroke school. And you're meant to cross two out and write the name of your place of education. If you're at university college school, you just end up essentially copying the three words out again. They think there is something wrong with this person. No, I was captain of Yeah, I was captain of rugby and captain of football, which we played in one before Christmas and one after Christmas.
Well, that sounds as though you were a very sporty individual. It's no wonder you put a ball on your list. This is clearly a champion at sport.
Yeah, well, I have I'm one of those people. If you go and go for walks, for example, I will always take a ball of some sort to throw to keep people occupied. Mainly the dog now, in fact, to be honest, rather than myself. Dogs love a ball.
Yes.
Cats, not so much, except in the form of balls of wool, if we're to believe Christmas cards and YouTube videos.
When an inflated rubber ball falls to the ground, it bounces back and players catch it on the rebound. This type of ball is at the heart of many games, from basketball to soccer to volleyball. At the core is an inflated rubber bladder. Making it starts with a sheet of natural rubber. The factory worker folds it in a specific configuration. He places a die on top and activates a press to force it through the layers, which cuts out the shape. He now has the bladder of a sports ball. He brushes an adhesive around the hole in the bladder and inserts a plug.
Okay, so you're pushing an open door as far as I'm concerned. It is, whether you can describe it as a wonder, which you do, or you just regard it as something that's woven into our lives, ball deserves its place on the list. So let's go on to your second wonder, if we may, though. Do you want me to tell you what that is?
Yeah, no, you tell me what my second wonder is, Clive.
All right, your second. The second wonder that you provided was the view from Waterloo Bridge at night.
Yeah, well, this is genuinely the case. If there are occasions, and these don't happen terribly often, where I feel a bit sort of low or, like life is a bit much, or I'm trying to think of an idea or anything like that, where you get a sort of a block, I will drive to Waterloo Bridge at night. You can't really stop anymore. I know that sounds very dodgy, Glove. I can see the...
It does. Well, I know. You say, I feel a bit low. I go to Waterloo Bridge, which is one of many bridges over the Thames, but one I think that used to have quite a big reputation as a suicide place. Yeah. I'm never quite sure if a bridge over a river is the ideal.
No, I think that would be terrible. I can assure you I don't go there for that reason.
No.
In fact, exactly the opposite. So I just think London at night, this is really the point, London at night seems to me an incredibly exciting place. And I think that Waterloo Bridge is just the best place to get that feeling, really. You know, and if we have people to stay, for example, and not sort of, from abroad or, wherever they've come from, quite often we'll drive them through London at night for exactly that reason, because it's just really exciting. It's much nicer than London during the day, it must be said.
Yes, I think that's true of almost all cities, though, isn't it? With a few lights on, buildings look better. You rub away some of the scruffiness. So you're certainly someone to go out with, stay with you in London and go out with them. You say, let's have a night out in London. You just drive them to the bridge and say, look, it's wonderful.
Drive them along the embankment, over the bridges, back past the Barbican. Oh, yeah. No, it's great, but it kind of has everything, because the... Well, I love London because I grew up in London, and my dad, who was a vicar, was the vicar of the Isle of Dogs when I was growing up. So I grew up by the river, really overlooking Greenwich, and then we sort of moved around London quite a lot. But I've always found it, and the history of it, absolutely fascinating place to live, because it's just got so many layers and bits and, different histories. And, it's just I'm just delighted that I have grown up here, really.
Yes. But did your father travel around a bit, though? Did he have different parishes and different places to be? He was a bishop in the end, wasn't he?
He was a bishop in the end, but he was, until I was sort of 8 or 9, we lived on the Isle of Dogs. So he had... prior to that, he'd been in Leeds and Kettering in Northamptonshire, which is where I was born. But we moved when I was 3 months old.
But so that's why you haven't got a wonder of the world isn't a view from a bridge in Kettering. It's so London has had more of an impact on you.
More of an impact on my life. And then we moved to sort of North London for the second half of teenage. But then he was made a bishop in Yorkshire and to Suffolk. So we did move around a bit, but mainly it was, you know, it was London really until I left home, and then my, you know, sort of parents went off. Really. But it's sort of amazing. I mean, I sort of almost every aspect of London. I've read so many books about like the lost rivers of London, for example.
Oh, yes.
You know, a history of the tube system and all that kind of stuff, which sounds so dull, but actually is just sort of fascinating, you know, and how the city grew up. And most of my degree, actually bits of my degree anyway, were about sort of the development of settlement. And London is sort of like the perfect example of almost all of it, really. But the view from Waterloo Bridge at night, I think, is just brilliant. You know, because you look one way, you look at the Shard, the other way, you look at the House of Commons, and you've got the river flowing through. I just think it's a magnificent view.
All right, well, I think that's a magnificent choice. So excellent. So you mentioned in passing there that in your degree you studied development of settlement. So you did 3 years at university doing geography.
I did.
So does that mean you're a great expert on Oxbow Lakes and the capital cities of South America? What do you do in 3 years of geography?
Well, you have to do a bit of physical geography in the first year. So geography at school, when I was at school, was mainly kind of physical and Oxbow Lakes, and glaciers and, you know, river formation and all that kind of stuff. And you have to do that for a year at university, but then you can kind of leave that behind and start doing economic geography and sort of social history, really. So I ended up doing, I think my final year papers were the philosophy of geography, which mainly turned out to be that there wasn't one, really.
Okay.
As far as I could work out, I did the economic geography of the post-Stalinist USSR.
Yeah.
I did a whole load of papers on the Green Revolution in India, so sort of the development of crops and the agricultural revolution, effectively, to provide more food in the subcontinent. What else did I do?
Well, I think we've got a rough idea. There's plenty there. They do sometimes sound a little bit random collections of things that it's a bit of economics, a bit of geology, a bit of this and that. But I suppose every subject strays into every other subject.
Well, sort of. But I think I think geography more than most actually is just a sort of an amalgam of bits, and it's largely for people who can't really decide quite what they want to do. But it is sort of irritating when you're I lived in Sussex for quite a long time, and I went to a dinner party in Sussex, and the lady who had invited us discovered that I had done geography, and I actually did quite well at geography, and I got a first
class degree. There's nothing to be scared at in a first class degree from Cambridge in geography.
But the husband of this woman had also got a first, but he got it in Oxford, I think, in jurisprudence, which is just law, isn't it? So is that just a fancy name?
Yes, it's a fancy. They're a bit fancy dans at Oxford. They can't just call it law.
Yeah, and she said. She asked me. She said, "What did you get? I understand you got a first class degree. What did you get? What did you get your degree in?" And I said, "Well, geography." To which she replied, "Oh, that doesn't count." That's a bit rude. He invited me for dinner and everything.
Yeah.
So there is that sort of feeling around geography, actually, that somehow. You know, history and English are kind of purer purer subjects because, you know, but the only things linking history that links, the only thing that links history together is the fact that it studies things that have happened. That's literally it, isn't it? And English is just stuff which has been written in English. And geography is stuff which happens in space, you know, not space, Darrow-Brien space, but, you know, just in Spain. That's it. That seems as pure to me as any of the other subjects, really.
Work began on the second bridge in 1939. Now, that date might ring a bell because it's the outbreak of World War II. The 500 men who were working on Waterloo Bridge was reduced to just 50 by 1941. That, coupled with bomb damage from the air raids, meant that progress was slow. That is until women joined the workforce. Waterloo Bridge has long had the nickname the Ladies Bridge, but it wasn't until Dr. Christine Wall uncovered photographic evidence showing individuals at work that they were finally recognised.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Join me, Jaguar, the host of BBC Introducing Dance on Radio 1 for my brand new podcast, Utopia Talks. It's a reactive platform to discuss issues that my generation care about in dance music culture and the wider world. I'll be talking to some of the biggest names in dance music, including people like Heidi.
The lineups do not need to be 99% male-driven. Mm. There's all these interesting new producers and women that are coming through, you know, all sorts. Yeah. It's like women are speaking out now.
And the sensational Bless Madonna.
I feel like literally my entire life has led up to this. This is the first event we've had like this, not just in the UK, but really in the Western Hemisphere. And to be able to be here with all of these people who are so happy is just absolutely the biggest, highest joy of my life.
As well as having the meaty conversations I often have with friends that I'd love you to join in with.
There's so much new energy coming out of the pandemic, and there's so many like new nights and festivals and everyone's really pushing for this new structure where people genuinely don't feel anxious about coming to a club night because of the way they look or the way they dress. It's more about everyone in.
To me, Utopia is a perfect moment. It's togetherness, it's the future. I want to live in a more inclusive, equal world, and I hope this podcast will build a community and help create change. Subscribe now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. New episodes dropping every Wednesday. Welcome to Utopia Talks.
Utopia Talks is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
This leads to your next wonder, though, Hugh, because your next wonder is maps. So this obviously links with geography. Or as you say, you can call it Earth Studies, but that's just saying it in English words rather than using classical languages. Geography and Earth Studies are the same thing. But anyway, maps. Tell me about maps.
Well, I suppose maps have always been a sort of fascination of mine, really. And the reason I put this down is kind of is twofold, I suppose. One, because I have been fascinated by them since I was a kid, and how maps help you understand the world in a way that, you know, writing it all down just doesn't. And you can map everything. And I remember doing a course at university where we mapped disease, and we did a study of the cholera outbreak in Soho, where they worked out actually in the end that cholera was this sort of waterborne thing, and that was done by mapping the cases that had happened around this pump in the middle of Soho in Broadwick Street by a guy called John Snow, in brackets, not that one.
And he'd worked out,
and he had worked out, you know, where the, all the cases of in this cholera outbreak were linked back to this pump. So he kind of, you know, maps. This is maps in a very general sense. So it's ordnance survey maps, which give you this sort of, you know, they're just brilliantly detailed view of the world. But the second reason for putting it down really is that I noticed this in my own kids really, because they're just not interested. They never use them. If I say to my son, he'll go, look, I've got this meeting in so-and-so street. And I'll say, well, okay, so I think you go along Conduit Street there, don't you? And then you turn left and you do a right. And he'll go, I've absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I don't know street names. I don't know anything like that, because I just go on Google Maps. As soon as I get out the tube or as soon as I get to the station, I'll turn on Google Maps and it will tell me which way to go. So it's motivated partly by this, you know, I feel there's a sort of loss. It's a loss that's sort of happening at the moment, that people just don't engage in maps because of sat-navs, because of, you know, GPS systems, that kind of stuff. And I think it is just, you know, we appear to be losing a really valuable view of the world that way.
So even your children, who've got your input on this and your evident, perhaps constant, dad's enthusiasm for maps, this hasn't had an effect on them. They haven't, they've probably riled against it or pushed against it.
I think
it,
so, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And my son even read geography and isn't interested in maps. What's going on, Clive?
So he followed you as far What's as happening? Geography is concerned, but not into the...
No, world. Not do you really have, into maps.
Do you have maps, you know, on your walls, you know, as a decorative item? Did you take it that far, or you is it just a sort of study and an understanding? You've got a big book of A to Z map books in your car that you consult as you're driving along, rather than using the sat nav.
Well, they do think it is slightly ridiculous that I have a road book in the car. I also think it's kind of funny that, you know, the government say, well, we've got this roadmap out of lockdown, because I think for most people they go, no one uses a roadmap. Let's get rid of sat nav out of lockdown. That would make a lot more sense. But a roadmap. And I remember having one, I took the kids to, we drove down sort of across the States at one point. And it always irritates me, like it probably does lots of parents, that when you're driving and they kind of assume that driving and navigating is all part of the same sort of thing, and they're so used to GPSs and stuff, that I bought a map, I think, of Tennessee or something, and they just refused to use it. They were on there. So could you please make sure that we get to wherever we're going? I can't remember, like Nashville or something. Yeah. And we ended up doing this like 90-mile detour because we'd missed a turning. And then they blame me. They blame me.
This does sound like an episode of Outnumbered.
Yeah, it is.
You, the frustrated dad with the kids not doing things the way you want them to do.
Beautifully cast. Yeah.
Well, the trouble with sitcoms is the dad is always the figure of fun. They're always one who trips up on things. It's just always has been, I suppose, always with them. What is it about dads? Why are we the subject of...
Because we're sort of faintly ridiculous, really, aren't we? I think.
Yeah.
Try and convince our children that we know best by... And then obviously... don't.
Well, I mean, I'm obviously asking you questions about you as a dad and as, you know, the frustrations of me. But what about you as a son? Because you mentioned your father was a vicar and then a bishop. In Scotland, at least, there's a very strong expression. People say, oh, he's the son of the manse. Somebody like, yeah, Gordon Brown is always, because he was a minister's son rather than a vicar, and there's a sort of particular type of upbringing that the kids of a religious leader have, which either means they become very well behaved or they become rebellious and fight against it. Which were you? Were you ever attracted into the church, or do you feel a lot of pressure to be well behaved because my dad's the vicar?
No, not really. I mean, there is an element of kind of being watched. You're sort of aware that people know who you are because, you know, you're living in the parish of which your dad is the vicar. But no, I think my parents were both very, very aware of the sort of pressures on clergy children. So they didn't really put any pressure on me and my brother at all, actually, that I can remember. I think we went to church. We certainly went to church, but I don't think we were forced to go to church. And, you know, I never felt I had to be tremendously good.
And what about just while I'm on this sort of theme, when you started doing comedy and performing either on stage at university and then at due course on television, radio, you know, every now and then, I would say it was to apply to you as much as anybody, you do the odd rude joke, the odd swear word, the odd thing that attacks institutions, including the church. Did you ever get any wigging from your father or suggestion? Oh, this is a bit strong, since think about where you come from.
No, not again. No, none, really. I mean, I think he was, they were really, really supportive. I do remember saying to him on one occasion, you know, it's quite difficult in my job having a dad who's a bishop. And he turned to me and he said, and I have to tell you that in my job, it's quite difficult having a son who's a comedian. And I thought, right, that's fine. But when I did Spitting Image, pretty well straight out of university, actually, for about four or five series. And one of my voices was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And this is how relaxed my dad was about it. He told the Archbishop of Canterbury that I did his voice, very proudly told the Archbishop of Canterbury. And it wasn't a terribly, you know, it was Carey, and he was kind of a tambourine bashing sort of, yeah, evangelical. It wasn't a great depiction of him. But he, you know, that's. But again, that's the Church of England, slightly. Actually, I've met an awful lot of vicars and priests and monks and, you know, whoever. And actually, the one thing that links them, the ones I know anyway, I'm sure this isn't true, but they all have, you know, pretty good sort of sense of humour about stuff. Actually,
yeah. I thought it's a slightly odd thing for your father to have done, though. He didn't, strictly speaking, have to tell his boss, no. I suppose, the Archbishop of Canterbury. My son is humiliating you on a weekly basis.
No, he was very proud of it, I think. He was very proud of it.
All right, first stop, Westminster Abbey.
Oh, what the hell is that?
That's London, baby. All right, the hotel's here.
Wait, no, we want to go.
No, I know. I'm gonna have to go into the map.
Okay, if you see a little version of me in there, kill it.
All right, so we've done maps, and your fourth wonder is the bicycle.
Yeah. Now I have always had a bicycle since, well, I suppose you know, as soon as you can ride a bicycle. How old would I have been?
Well, I should imagine you were an early developer. You'd have been at about three or four or something. But maybe
I think I was on the
six.
Steady wheels for a long time. You don't see steady wheels now, but I was on the steady wheels for quite a long time. And I love bikes. And I think one of the great things which has happened in the last couple of decades, probably, maybe even the last decade, is that when I was growing up, there was a point at which, you know, in late teenage or something, you had to give up your bike to look grown up, and you had to get a moped, and you had to, you couldn't go riding round on a bike at the age of, you know, sort of 20, you know, because people would have thought you were ridiculous to do that. You had to have a motorbike and a girlfriend by that point. But now you never, ever have to give up your bicycle. You can go right through, go the whole way through life with a bicycle. It's fantastic. And it's such a good invention. I mean, it's never been, it's so simple, isn't it?
Well, I must make it, sorry to be a bit sort of a devil's advocate here. Earlier on, you were saying the ball was so much more important than the wheel. And we're only two or three wonders on. And now your bicycle is essentially two wheels joined together with a frame. So the wheel does turn out to be a useful thing. You couldn't make a bicycle out of two balls.
I think you could, but it wouldn't be so good at getting through narrow gaps. I'll give you that.
But I know you are, even at your, let's say, advanced stage, you're an enthusiastic cyclist. Didn't you cycle round the Tour de France route not very long ago?
Well, there is an for the French. The equivalent of the London Marathon for a lot of French people is a thing called the étape, which is, but it's on bikes, clearly. You can't use a bike in the London Marathon. That's cheating, apparently.
You've tried. Yeah. You make it look like a rhino costume, but it's in fact a bicycle inside.
Yeah, exactly. Hidden under the costume. That's a brilliant idea, actually. Deep sea diver on a bicycle. But anyway, they do a thing called the étape, and that is one stage of the Tour de France. So every year, and they do it 2 weeks or so before the actual race goes through. So the and whereas in the race there are, I don't know how many riders there are in the Tour de France, probably 70 or 80. In the étape, there are 8,000 entrants. And it's generally a mountain stage. So I've done two of them, both in the Pyrenees. And it's about 200 kilometers or so. Mostly up. Well, the bits that aren't up are down. There's very little flat.
Very you were going to say mostly stuff. Uphill, but obviously it's mostly.
I thought, hang on.
It's roughly equal.
Although you do finish. I did finish at the top of a hill on one occasion. And it's great. But I think I did that as a slight midlife crisis, because I think if you're going to have a midlife crisis, you might as well have one that lasts 12 hours. That's all it is. And then you've gone.
But I'm sure your midlife crises have lasted longer than that, even if you include cycling, because are you one of these guys? I think there's even a cruel acronym about it's middle-aged men in Lycra.
Mammals
who wander around or cycle around the city, shouting at people to get out of the way, going through red lights, riding on pavements, using the bike lane only when they... Are you one of those people?
I try not to be. I do go through the occasional red light. I have to admit that I treat myself slightly as a pedestrian occasionally, even though I'm clearly not on a bicycle. But and I do wear Lycra. I do wear Lycra, but this is, I think you should really only wear Lycra when you're kind of out in the country doing a long run. I'm not sure it works in town, partially because you have to then go to meetings wearing Lycra, and that's not good.
Years ago, when I was a barrister, I didn't use a bicycle. I did have a motorbike, and the difficulty there was keeping your, you know, fairly proper looking suit clean and dry from riding on a bike and wearing extra clothes. So I took for a while to wearing jeans and changing into my suit trousers when I got to court. But inevitably there was a day that I arrived with the jeans and I'd forgotten to bring the correct pair of trousers.
Oh, no.
It's a moot point as to whether a judge can hear you if you're wearing the wrong clothing. But they insist you wear a waistcoat and the various other clobber and wig and so forth in court. But I got away with it because jeans aren't a bit like a newsreader.
He didn't realize that you were wearing them.
No, I had a you know, a gown as well, so I kept myself wrapped around, and I think I would have got away with it anyway because I could have entertained him with my story of getting to court on a motorbike.
Did you win the case? That's the key thing.
Of course I did. You'll know if you've ever spoken to a barrister, they only ever talk about cases that they won. Mysteriously lost cases.
Yeah, you've never lost one.
No. They never talk about them.
It was not until the 1860s that someone had the idea of the most simple thing, which was to put a set of pedals on the front wheel. The first commercial producer of such machines was the Michaud family in Paris, and they started to produce machines in numbers, and these were designated and called the velocipede. They were still wooden wheels made like cartwheels, an iron, a forged iron frame, a suspended saddle, front wheel steering. Eventually, the design settled about 1890 into the conventional machine that we recognize today.
Anyway, so that was a bicycle. In your fifth wonder, which does take us back, I suppose, I don't know, into the world of geography, is the South Downs.
Yeah, well, it does. It firmly takes us back into the world of geography, really. So I was, in spite of my cynicism about the pyramids at Giza, I was thinking in terms of, the great sort of ancient wonders and how you kind of get affected by things that you see, right? And while pyramids don't do it for me particularly, landscape does. I mean, I have this sort of great need for kind of hills and coast and sort of, you know, standing on the top of things and being buffeted around by the wind and sort of looking for miles. I just adore doing that kind of stuff. And whereas most people's version of that, I suppose, in this country would be the lakes or, you know, standing atop the Pennines or in Scotland or something, I have this sort of an enormous affection for the South Downs, and I lived in the South Downs, which is now National Park, for about sort of 15, 20 years, really, and just love it. It's rolling. I could give you the kind of geological history of the South Downs.
I'm tempted to ask you to do that, because that would be
if you so wish.
Educational than...
So, yeah. I may be entirely wrong, of course, about this. This is the other thing about geography. It just involves superficial knowledge of an awful lot of things without really knowing any of them very well. But anyway, the South Downs is obviously chalk downland, but it wouldn't have started as chalk downland, because chalk clearly is dead sea creatures, and they don't live at the top of hills particularly. So they would have been at the bottom of an ocean or a sea. Mm. And then at some point, and this is the kind of interesting thing, I think, about the South Downs, the thing that created the South Downs, so the was a thing called the Alpine Orogeny, which sounds very rude, but in fact just was the coming
the
together.
Movie,
it was the coming together of the two plates, the kind of Eurasian plate and another one that I can't actually remember now I've come to talk about it. But the two plates forced the Alps up and caused the ground around them to ripple. And the outermost ripple of the thing that created the Alps is the South Downs. Uh-huh. And it was sort of uplifted at that period. And then even later, so not only a few hundred thousand years ago, it created actually a sort of a chalk dome, this final ripple of the Alps, which went from southern England right into France. So it kind of went across to Champagne, and, you know, that whole lot was just sort of chalk downland. And then at the end of the Ice Age, there was a lake which was sort of up near Holland somewhere, which sort of burst, I suppose, and the river which came from this meltwater lake carved out the English Channel and cut the hole in this enormous chalk dome. So you have similar landscapes in northern France and in southern Britain of just beautiful sort of wavy chalk, which wasn't originally wavy. And
but what I could, if I could just tie the question to the idea of wonders, a lot of people walking along the South Downs, let's say, would say, "Well, this is a wonder of nature. This is absolutely fantastic. I've got a view over there, the chalk just beneath the cropped grass. Maybe things have been carved. It's such a wonder." But you bring a sort of an intellectual or academic understanding of why it is where it is. Does that make it seem more wonderful because it involves, let's say, thousands of years of geological time producing this result, or does understanding it become sort of, it's less of a wonder, more of a, "Oh yes, that's quite interesting, and that's why the chalk stream goes in that direction." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I think it makes it feel more wonderful, actually, because you sort of a vague understanding, terribly vague understanding of the forces that create it. Sort of, and this sounds terribly sort of crass, but it does kind of put everything into perspective. And I kind of hate saying that, really, but you sort of realise that you know you being here, me being here, everything being here, towns being here, this landscape being here, we're just these tiny sort of little points in time, aren't we, compared with this sort of whole. And it's not going to stay like this. That's one of the things I think about when you're on the South Downs. Everything feels terribly static, doesn't it? So you think, "Oh, the South Downs will always be there. The Grampians will always be there." But they won't. You know, we won't, but they'll constant, it's constantly changing in such a subtle way that you don't really know. I mean, I'm amazed always by this fact that the hills in Scotland were as high as the Himalayas and are now the lowest pretty much in Europe. It's always slightly embarrassing, isn't it, when you go, "What is the highest hill in Britain?" Well, I'm telling you what, Snowdon is 3,560 feet, is it? You know, and we've got sort of bumps in France that are taller than that. But it's just this idea of timescale. It's just how sort of massive, you know, these lengths of time are.
This whole area was once a huge dome of chalk created by the same tectonic forces that pushed the Alps and the Himalayas up out of the ground. And at the end of the last ice age, a huge swathe of meltwater carved out the heart of the Downs, leaving the Thames Valley to the north, and here, the South Downs.
So that was your fifth wonder. Your sixth wonder is the days between Christmas and New Year.
Yeah.
Now, what's this about?
What's all that about? Well,
I'm saying it like that because most people might say they are the dead years. They are the dead days. They between Christmas, Boxing Day, maybe good fun. New Year, you might look forward to. But in between, there's a few days. The last person that spoke to me about those days, and I'm not making this up, say that in their family, they call it the perineum these days, which is that.
Yeah, they're a medical family.
Which is not
family,
a compliment. So, what is why do you make them not only popular days, but an actual wonder of the world, a wonder of Hugh Dennis's world?
Because they are my favourite days of the year. Because when I had, you know, a proper job, when I worked at Unilever, for example, and you go away on your summer holiday and you came back to the office and you wanted to talk to people about this fantastic holiday that you'd had, no one was interested because none of them had been on holiday, right? And there was a sort of, "Oh, yeah, no, that sounds great, yeah. Now, have you got these sales figures for the last quarter?" That was how long the conversation lasted. But between Christmas and New Year, it is a time when there is no pressure on you, really, and everyone is on holiday. So, you know, you end up meeting mates and going off and doing stuff, and everybody's in the same boat. There's this sort of great collective feeling of, you know, which could be boredom, in the case of the family who call it the perineum. But for me, it's just this period of tremendous sort of relaxation, because everybody is doing the same thing, except if they're working in a shop, I suppose, when it's probably the most busy time of the year, or was before online shopping. I just love them. I just love those days. I find them tremendously relaxing. And you don't have to, your phone isn't important because nobody's really calling you and you're not thinking, I should be doing something else. It's just, they're just great. They're great days. And I think Christmas has a stress, doesn't it? Boxing Day has a stress. New Year's Eve has the stress of, you know, looking forward and looking back.
Yeah. And will it live up to anticipation? Yeah. I don't mean there. But those few days, those dull days, as people might describe, you like the lack of stress, the lack of pressure for them to be great. But you know, I'm not sure I follow the holiday point, because some people go on holiday at that time. So presumably there's still the sort of describing, oh, yeah, we went skiing, or, oh, we flew off to... This is pre-lockdown, obviously.
Yeah, but you would... it's slightly different because everybody is on holiday, aren't they? You will listen to those stories of skiing accidents and whatever else is happening. You know, it just is a much calmer... sort of more communal sort of experience, I think.
I suppose in your grown-up life as a TV performer, these are relaxing days, because the Christmas special of, I don't know, Mock the Week, you know, the year-end special would have been recorded in October or November or whatever. Similarly, when you're in a sitcom, the Christmas episode of Outnumbered, that again would have been recorded in August and people cutting the leaves off the trees to make it look like December. So perhaps that's another reason why it's a relaxed time for you.
Yeah, I mean, because nothing happens. I think it is really just that, you know, perhaps I'm just one of those people who always feels he has to be doing something, between Christmas and New Year, when I don't feel I should be doing anything.
Yeah, well, you can go for a walk on the South Downs. Relaxing. Yeah, you can take your map out, South Downs, take a ball with you.
As long as I can
get
back to Waterloo Bridge of an evening, I'm fine.
So has going into comedy transformed your life in a way, taking it right out of the way that you would have been? If you hadn't been doing comedy with Steve Punt in your spare time, what you might be, I don't know, I'm sure beyond area manager, you might be running Unilever. Have you got a sort of sliding doors aspect to where life might have been without?
Well, possibly. I mean, I've never really had a plan. I mean, I think I'm quite sort of determined once I'm doing a thing, but I've never really had a plan, which is kind of useful actually, because when good things happen, you go, oh, this is fantastic. I wasn't expecting that. And I think that's sort of how I've run it, really. I also have this feeling that I would have been happy doing lots of things. I mean, again, you'll be able to put me right on this, but I quite often thought I would have been quite happy being a barrister.
Yes, or, I can see you as a barrister.
Or in marketing, I really liked. I like lots and lots of things, which I think is why I read geography. It's all perfectly coming back.
Okay.
It's a perfect segue to so many different things.
Can I ask you just one thing about an interesting, I suppose, quirk really of your personal life, is that you've spent several years pretending to be married in Outnumbered with Claire Skinner, and now life now imitates that in the sense you are with her in a relationship of several years standing. I mean, that's must be relatively unusual. I mean, it could have gone either way in that. You could have ended up in a partnership with Dara O'Brien from
I could have done. You know, I asked him if we could bubble at the start of lockdown, and he refused. No, it's great. I mean, it's... yeah, it's splendid. Neither of us really sort of expected it to.
No.
You know, but it no,
but did it help, because you've been through a number of the life crises as interpreted by the comedy writers, you know, the
Andy Hamilton's version.
Andy Hamilton's version of a married life. You've already dealt with it, and it's not
It means you have a shared history, doesn't it? You know, we go back, you know, we work together for a long time. And that, you know, so you have memories going back quite a long time, which is...
So
which
she
is
can't nice. Complain if you start talking about maps and the South Downs and how marvellous...
I'm not sure I ever did that in outnumbered rehearsals. Can you imagine?
I bet you
Claire,
did.
Claire, look at this. This is an 1815 map of... Aldershot.
Look, here's a church without a tower, you see, and that's why it's represented.
That's a different symbol. Yes, that's right.
We get so confused by they've started to change. The days aren't called Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Now they're called, you know, Boxing Day, Christmas Eve, so you lose track of it. And you're so full and hungover as well. People are just wandering around in a daze. What day is it? I don't even know what day it is. Are the shops open? Do the shops open? The sales started. I don't know what day it is. Should I start my diet today? Do I start it today? Is there post today? Does the post come back? Can I park here today? What day is it? Can I park here?
All right, we've got one more wonder to go. What's the wonder that we're getting?
The wonder, this is wonder, and this is only, you know, it's not a wonder, is it? Really, I'm not quite sure why it's there, other than the fact that, you know, I love it, is toast. I just cannot imagine a world without toast. And therefore,
no, sorry, it's I'm become a wonder. I'm just enjoying that. You cannot imagine a world without toast. Yeah.
You know when they... again, this is a slight religious background thing. I remember thinking, even when I was very young, when they went, you know, man cannot live by bread alone. And I thought, well, I think if it was toast, I reckon you probably could. It saved me so many decisions over the years, toast. You go, what am I going to eat? No, I'm going to have toast. And off I go. I have a slice of toast. It's amazing. Spent so much money on different toast technologies. You know, different toasters.
Oh, you've gone into all this. That. So you have you got a particular form of toasting that you think produces the best toast?
No, not. I mean, in the end, a toaster's a toaster, Clive.
No, but you know when you're in those hotels. I have experimented. You know when those hotels that sometimes you there's a buffet of dozens of different things if you're lucky, and but there's some people standing next to a little sort of. Little device that is sending bits of bread along a track.
No point.
And to be sure you could do without toast once in your life when you've got 9 different types of croissant, 3 different porridges, bacon, eggs, and all the other things.
No, I will still go for the toast. I'm thinking, what is it about hotels that says they can't have a normal toaster? That you have to have a conveyor belt that puts it about a foot away from the element. I don't understand that. I just simply don't understand it. Is it they need to get 7 or 8 slices in at once? Just get yourself a longer toaster or 2 toasters next to each other.
I think, I mean, I don't want to argue about all of your wonders, but, you know, toast has its downside. Yeah. An awful lot of, you know, fire alarms go off simply because in the college room or the nurse's home or the hospital or the hotel, whatever, is because a toaster has produced slightly too much smoke. And you think, well, why can't people just have plain bread? You know, if this is going to cause all this trouble, but this would destroy your happiness if you couldn't have
it. It would entirely destroy my happiness. And I also think on that point of smoke alarms and toasters that, you know, that phrase, there is no smoke without fire. I think no one who said that has ever made toast. There's regularly smoke without fire, as there is in a wet bonfire. We all know there's smoke without fire.
Yeah. It always strikes me about toast, though, that I thought it must have been invented really to deal with stale bread, that you never would have started toasting bread until it was a bit off. Oh, well, let's try just cooking it up a bit and making a bit. Oh, it's just about acceptable. I haven't ever seen it as this, you know, the epitome of the perfect piece of food, you do indeed. To give toast its due, Nigel Slater, the food writer, he called his autobiography Toast because that was his sort of entry point or one of his entry points into his love affair.
It's one of the simplest things to cook.
Yes.
Let's be honest, almost anyone could manage a slice of toast.
Yes. I must admit I've been asked to provide recipes for celebrity cookbooks and things over the years, and for many, many times of asking, I used to always give a recipe for toast, but that was meant as a satirical take on the whole process rather than an enthusiasm. Did you know, Hugh, that toast was first done to put into beer as a flavouring for drink? That's what toast
would
was.
Would you leave it, what, into the barrel? You wouldn't get a pint of beer with a slice of toast.
Wherever you put it in, and having gone in, you then threw it away. It took some centuries for people to say, wait a minute, we don't just have to do that. We could eat that. That's got a nice smell to it. And that's why toasting somebody, you know, your good health, that's why that's called toast, is because it came from toast being put into a drink.
So it was this kind of beer crouton.
But not even a crouton you ate. It was a crouton you put in and then threw away.
And did it go in as a complete slice, or did they bother to sort of chop it up into smaller bits to spread the flavour more equally round? You don't know.
You've caught me. Yes, my knowledge, thin as it was in the first place, is now definitely snapped.
Proceed to introduce heat to your piece of bread by pressing down on the lever. Easy. Now, we just wait a while. What we're witnessing right now is the transformation from bread to toast. What we put in was bread. What we're gonna get out is toast. You could take this time and prepare for the next step by putting on these gloves. These are heat and knife resistant gloves. They're very handy and safe to have in the kitchen. Perfect. It's almost a spitting image.
Well, look, Hugh, thank you very much for going through your seven wonders. The rules of the game require me to select a wonder of wonders, the best one. I'm not going to make it toast, I'm afraid. Toast crops up in conversation in my house because I've always kicked back at the idea of people say something is as warm as toast. And I, warm toast is warm. Toast, most of its life, three minutes after it's been made, it's cold again. So anything can be, it's as warm as something that's warm. But so I'm not going to have toast on that basis. I think with remarkably few duplications of the guests that I've discussed this with, there's just one here that we've discussed before. But I think maps, I'm a big fan of maps as well. And since it relates to your academic studies and everybody's understanding of the world, and the maps can be beautiful things as well as useful things. I'm going to make maps, if I may, your wonder of wonders. But anyway, Hugh Dennis, thank you very much.
Do you send me a map or anything? Is there any? There's nothing. I don't get sent a map of.
I note your request, and I will make sure that in the fullness of time, I provide you with a magnificent map in commemoration of this conversation.
This moment.
This particular conversation. Thank you very much, Hugh Dennis, for giving us your seven wonders. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.